This is Colleen, and I'm here with Roger Walsh. Welcome,
Great.
Roger.
Thank you so much. Maybe we can start by dedicating this. May our exploration of these practices, may our exploration of these practices serve our awakening and thereby the awakening and welfare of all. So I understand you're into the mandala offering practices, having run through, for the most part, the preceding Nundra practices. And so maybe we could start by talking a little bit about some of the principles that underlie the mandala offering practice, and then go into some of the specifics.
Right.
And I think probably the most important thing that strikes me in this practice is that it's based on a very profound and incredibly important principle of how the mind works, but one which is, at least outside spiritual traditions, very little and tragically little understood or recognized. And this is the principle that within the mind, what you intend for another, you tend to create in your own. That is, within the mind, the experience you intend another person or being to have tends to be created in your own mind. And this is the basis of many spiritual practices, especially those that used to cultivate interpersonal emotions. They're the basis of the Brahmaviharas and the Brahmavihara emotions, loving-kindness, compassion, empathic joy, and equanimity. They underlie the Buddha's words. I love his words from the Dhammapada, all that you give to yourself. And also his words, if you knew the power of generosity as I do, you would not sit down to a meal without sharing it. And it's a principle which underlies the possibility of creating not only those emotions, but also happiness, joy, and also underlies the possibility of creating to degrees far beyond what we usually think of as possible. It's one of the most powerful recognitions for me in doing, say, the Brahmavihara practices and the mandala offering, is these practices really can induce degrees of joy and care for others that far exceeds what we're used to in daily life. And, of course, this general principle of that in giving we receive, or as the Christian mystics say, to give and to receive are one in truth. This principle is so at odds with the usual mundane understanding that to give is to lose, that to give is sacrifice. And there's just so little appreciation within our culture that the principles that operate within the mind are so very different from the principles that operate in the physical universe. And there, you know, if you do give something, you do lose it. But within the mind, it's the opposite. Thoughts, emotions, ideas are actually strengthened by being shared. And that, boy, I think if we could just get that one idea out into the world, it would be a very different planet. This principle underlies a variety of practices. Of course, it underlies the practice of dana, or generosity, or giving, which is the first paramita. It underlies the four immeasurables. It underlies mandala offering. And it underlies a variety of yidam practices, also Chinrezi, Tara, and Vajrakalaya, which you've done. So what these practices have in common, if you look at them, is that they all involve offering in physical reality or within the realm of mind, gifts to others. And they know that whatever we intend for others, whether it's be love or joy or freedom from fear or guilt or anger, we will experience ourselves. And we'll not only experience ourselves, but reinforce within ourselves so that those emotions, particularly emotions, are strengthened and arise more frequently with greater intensity and with greater resistance to perturbation in the future. And that points to the idea that the mandala practice, like offering practices in general, also have additional effects on the mind, additional benefits. First, they decondition and weaken egocentric attachments and afflictions, craving, greed, jealousy, egocentricity, this kind of constellation of ego-centered and ego-aggrandizing motives. And they strengthen a variety of positive qualities, whether it's empathic joy or generosity or a whole slew of positive mental factors. I find it useful to think of the practices of generosity as, like so many other practices, and like the cultivation of so many other positive mental qualities or mental factors, as developing through successive stages. And I think that's one of the keys to the recognition here in all practices. They really do develop. And I'm repetitively struck by when I take up a new practice that, of course, initially I can't do it, and sooner or later the thought will likely arise, oh, I can't do this. And then, as with so many other things, if you just keep practicing, if you keep doing it, the mind kind of gets in train and goes along for the ride, and sooner or later the qualities or states of mind you're trying to cultivate arise. And one trick that is so crucial in these practices is that we don't have to create the mental qualities we're aiming for. That is, in fact, to even try to generate kindness or love or whatever can be a bit of a trap, because actually that just sets up a goal to which we become attached, and then we set up inhibiting factors, etc., and just stop the process. And one of the great secrets of this and so many practices is that actually if we just do the practice with as little attachment as possible, then the very qualities we're seeking will arise, quite apart from and even better because of the fact that we're not quite apart from our striving to create them. So generosity, which of course is the paramita that the mandala offering aims to cultivate, proceeds through a variety of stages. The classic stages in the Theravadin tradition are threefold: the beggarly, sibling, and royal. Beggarly giving being the giving we do when we give regretfully, miserly, and give as little as we possibly can get away with. Sibling generosity is where we share equally. And royal giving is when we happily give the best of what we have. And that's a beautiful progression. Now, of course, if you look at the Brahmaviharas, you can see that the generosity actually extends further in the Theravadin tradition, and of course in Mahayana Vajrayana, and that is to a kind of boundless giving. There's also an interesting development through successive stages of motivation that underlie or power giving. At first, one of the dominant motives, and one we see so much in the world, is giving to get, a kind of business generosity. I'll give you this, but overtly or covertly, I'm expecting at least as much in return. Then there's giving out of generosity. Giving out of obligation, out of duty. And that can, you know, it has its place, but there's also a trickiness to it in as much as it can breed resentment. So it's something we have to watch out for. Then there's another kind of generosity which can look very much like compassion, but it's actually the near enemy of compassionate giving, and that's giving out of pity. Giving in which we subtly look down on the recipient. And the key giveaway for pity-based generosity is it's based on aversion. It's not based on compassion, which is a needless warmth and care for the other. I remember when before I started doing the Brahma Vihara practices, Joseph Goldstein gave a talk on these Brahma Viharas and spoke of compassion and saying there is no aversion whatsoever in compassion. And I just couldn't believe it. I actually went up to him afterwards and said, "Are you sure there's no aversion? There's no giving out of discomfort with the other's suffering?" He said, "Why don't you just try the practice?" And when I eventually did, I wasn't more than about 15 minutes into it when I realized I spent my life totally misunderstanding what compassion is about. I had, for example, gone to Mother Teresa's center in Calcutta and worked there. And, you know, I think there were certainly some skillful motives at work, but boy, a lot of it was aversion. I mean, I just was so upset by the amount of suffering there. And of course, you know, pity-based generosity has its role, but it's certainly nowhere near the culmination of the practice. Then there's a motive which is based on, to a significant extent, it can arise spontaneously or it can arise just out of experience, but also very much arises out of the mandala offering and related practices. And that is a motivation of enlightened self-interest. After you've done these practices for a while and after you've done the first paramita, you know, after you've practiced generosity, you realize it feels good. Mm-hmm. And it's really a shift from a win-lose perspective to a win-win perspective. We realize that giving feels good, it's good for our relationships, it's good for our well-being, and it's good for our development. And that's a pretty healthy motive. But it's not the culmination of the motives for generosity and for giving or for offering. There is, of course, the motive which is so central to Buddhism. In fact, it's the emotion which one might say is the emotion par excellence in Buddhism, which, of course, is compassion. That warm, warm, non-egoic, unneedful caring for another. And then along with that comes a kind of empathic joy, just simply the joy of giving, which of course is related to enlightened self-interest, but it can be more fully developed than just the insight. Empathic joy really can develop to transcendental dimensions and scope and be entirely unconditional and unbounded. And that is one of the gifts of the mandala offering practice, of course, the, we think of it as giving, and perhaps we even start with the idea of it as kind of sacrifice in way. But I guess for me, one of the great discoveries of these Nundro practices was that they were so joyful. I wasn't really expecting that. Of course, there were difficulties along the way, and aches and pains and neuroses arising and getting in the way and so forth. But my goodness, once they get going, they do turn out to be extraordinarily joyful. And empathic joy is certainly one of the main emotions that's fostered there. And then finally, there's the Mahamudra Dzogchen perspective of non-duality. The recognition that indeed it is not hyperbolic to say that all that I give is given to myself. It really is true, and that's a very deep, profound recognition. And then, of course, you know, the whole question of sacrifice or division between self and others dissolves. So there's a wonderful evolution or development that can be seen in ourselves as we do these practices. I'm intrigued by the way that we tend to recapitulate within ourselves the evolution of Buddhism. And if we look at the evolution of Buddhism across the three or four yanas, then we can recognize that some of this developmental process we go through and the stages we go through as we do the mandala offering actually reflect or recapitulate the evolution of the whole tradition. One of the key recognitions about generosity, or actually any positive mental state, is that generosity is both a means to and an expression of awakening. And it's interesting that in many ways we can think of it as the culmination of the practice, that we don't practice just for ourselves alone, but because if you think you're alone, then you're just reinforcing the belief in a separate self. But we practice for ourselves, certainly, because that self-other dichotomy is fundamentally illusory. We would practice also for the benefit of others. There's a Dalai Lama tells a wonderful story, which I just love, talking about being caught up in the busyness of his many roles and thinking, oh, it'd be just so wonderful if I wasn't so busy doing all these things and could practice and get enlightened. And then we thought a bit and thought, well, okay, well, if I was enlightened, well, what would I do? And he realized, well, I'd try to be as helpful to beings as I can, which actually is, I guess, what I'm doing. So maybe enlightenment isn't all that important. And I thought that was such a wonderful story. I mean, there's probably very few people on the planet who are as helpful or serving as much or effectively as he is. And from such a deeply awakened perspective, and for him to see the non-duality of the weight of the practice and expression dimensions is just wonderful. So all the story was on the way to talking about the recapitulation of our own development and developmental stages in the Buddhist tradition, or better, that we recapitulate some of those stages. And these stages I owe to Lama Suryadas, who pointed that out, that each of the different yanas adds another degree of understanding Each of the yanas includes and transcends the previous practices in some ways. And for the Theravadin, the emphasis is on giving physical objects and, once one's matured, teaching. For the Mahayana, the emphasis is more on, or at least as much on, giving of oneself, and the service takes on an increasingly central role, along with the emotion of compassion. In Vajrayana, there's an additional emphasis, which is on visualization and ritual, particularly the practices of soak and chud, with the appreciation that visualization adds another dimension of heightened power to the giving practices. And then in Mahamudra Dzogchen, there's the perspective of self-offering, in which we see everything as always already self-arising and self-offering. So that's an interesting evolution there. You have any comments?
Well, no, I really am appreciating everything you're saying. Why don't you share? Well, no, keep going. Let's keep going. Let me just check one thing. I just want to make sure the light's on.
Okay. Well, since mandala offering is such a powerful visualization practice, probably be good to talk about some of the advantages that visualization confers. One of the key things to know, and I love it when contemporary science catches up with ancient wisdom, is that the brain-mind responds similarly to images as to physical stimuli. So that just reinforces the wonderful ancient idea that in doing visualization practices, we can literally shape and hone the mind-brain in very similar ways as we can with physical behavior. Now, the advantage of visualization over physical activity is that images can be expanded and multiplied beyond physical limits. We can give not only one offering, but almost boundless numbers of offering. We can give them not to just one being, but to boundless numbers of beings. And therefore, the power of the practice can be amplified. Now, you know, we traditionally in Nundro said that the power of visualization is a function of the clarity of the visualization,
the clarity and
Vajra pride is the third.
Yeah.
Vajra pride is the sensing of one's, the recognition of oneself as, in fact, the archetypal image or deity or, you know.
Right.
And
would the second be?
Understanding of the symbols? Is that?
Yeah. Maybe it's understanding the symbols.
I think it's understanding of the symbols. But I think my own experience is that the power of visualization is also a function of its scope, of the value of what we offer, and the profundity of the being to whom we offer it. Now, mandala offering makes superb use of these principles. Specifically in the practice, you practice offering or giving as much as you can conceive of, the most valuable things you can conceive of, to the most valuable beings you can conceive of, and you do it as wholeheartedly and happily as you can. And you make the best of both worlds. You combine symbolic physical activity with symbolic imagery. The physical activity forms a base for the visualization. Now, people vary, and groups and lineages vary in the emphasis they give to the physical and the mental. For myself, I found the visualization more powerful than the actual physical activity. And I guess I should warn people that there's a spectrum in Buddhism between conservative and experimental. Conservatives wanting to stick pretty closely to what the teacher's teacher said or instructed, and the experimentalists wanting to basically try different variations and see what works best for them. And I should warn that I am very much on the extreme end of the experimental scale.
Okay.
That I have experimented in all sorts of ways with these practices, with different images, mm-hmm. with different variations, with different mantras, etc., etc., and in a quest to find what was most efficacious for me.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately for me, I had a good match in being with Lama Suryadas, who's also very open-minded and experimental. And so I ended up doing more visualization than physical activity in the mandala offering. And I found that was very effective for me. I also varied the mantra till I found one which really worked for me. I used much more English than Tibetan, mm-hmm. which again worked for me. I think, you know, having terms and words we understand evokes their corresponding meaning and symbol.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the way I kind of worked with this. And of course, different teachers and lineages have their own emphasis. So, but my own bias would be to encourage an experimentation, at least, you know, within the bounds of what a teacher permits, and particularly at the beginning of a practice. I think there's a kind of developmental process that practices can go through. And in that development, my sense is, and this is an idea I originally got from Ram Dass, but it's certainly held true in my experience. In the beginning, it can be valuable to try a kind of smorgasbord experimental approach.
Mm.
You know, we enter these practices, they're rich, they're complex, there are all sorts of possible variations. And one thing I hadn't realized till I started reading was that there are enormous variations not only between lineages, but within lineages.
Yeah.
And after you begin to explore a little, you realize that, well, you know, lots of other people, and some very great people at that, have experimented in various ways. And then they passed down what they found worked for them. And sometimes that ossifies into dogma,
mm-hmm.
and other times it's just guidelines. But I have found there's real value in initially being open to experimentation, seeing what works best for me, and then settling into what I found is effective.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my kind of frame for this. And, of course, everyone needs to find their own comfort level for experimentation and, of course, you know, follow guidelines of the teacher. So that's a kind of overview of the principles.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. That's really helpful. And I guess I'm wondering, given that overview, can you say a little bit more about how, for you at least, or how you see it fits into the overall Nendro practice? And then, you know, how does the... just say a little bit more about that, how it fits in.
Let's see. Well, they seem wonderfully complementary.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first thing that stands mm-hmm. out. Clearly, each of them develops multiple qualities of mind at multiple levels of mind. And I have to say, I do not pretend to understand all the ways in which these practices work.
Mm-hmm.
I think they are profound archetypal therapies and transformative disciplines, by which I mean that the images are archetypal images. They are archetypal identities, or at least they symbolize archetypal identities. And they work at that deep archetypal level of mind, in addition to all sorts of other levels, some of which we're aware of, some of which we become aware of only much later in my experience, and some of which, for me anyway, I'm sure await discovery. So I think we can look at each practice in the Nundro series and see how each one reflects a different archetype and a different facet of our transcendental identity, focuses on the cultivation of specific positive mental qualities or emotions, and somehow, in ways I don't fully understand, I think are wonderfully complementary.
Mm.
I'd be interested, you know, because you make me realize I haven't thought about this question of how they relate one to another as fully as I could benefit from. So I'm just wondering what your perspective is.
Well, I guess just in the simplest sense, you know, just thinking about my own experience with it, the refuge just felt like it really opened the devotion and the kind of surrender to the whole process, really.
Yes.
But also just cultivating devotion and cultivating intention to move with the practice, connection with the lineage. And the Vajrasattva, of course, the purification, the bringing attention and the acknowledgement and the release, you know, of what's blocking. And with the mandala, as you said, you know, it resonates for me, just more of that discovery. And I remember the day that I was walking and it just opened up. And for me, it was very much in the heart center, probably because of, you know, a lot of metta practice. So the spontaneously opening to the qualities of compassion, the qualities of offering and generosity. And it's hard to put into words. It's at an experiential level. I see them kind of, it feels like something is kind of relating and building a little bit toward. And I've done a little bit of guru yoga, and that feels like a kind of, in a sense, just at this very beginning stage for me, it feels like a kind of more mature refuge taking, like a higher level of devotion and opening to my own intimacy with, or I don't know if intimacy is the right word, but a profound kind of recognition of what is not there and what is, or I don't know how to put it into words at this point, but there is a quality, yeah.
Well, you may not know how to put it into words, but I'm getting it. I'm thinking, gee, I should go back and do that practice again. Yes, I think you said a couple of important things there, and one I want to make sure doesn't get lost, and that was you said that perhaps the offering practices come a little more easily for you because you've done metta practice.
Mm-hmm.
And I would agree. I think for me, that was definitely my experience. That the metta practice, in fact, all the Brahmavihara practices, really eased the way for this practice. And although I didn't go back and forth between them, I can imagine that doing so would be very powerful.
Well, I was just going to ask, along those lines, if Given that in the metta practice, in the beginning, they have often you start, when you're really starting out, focusing on something that's very easy, say if you're doing loving kindness.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you have found any kind of correlation with a mandala. If a student was struggling with kind of really getting the richness of it, do you have any suggestions that would kind of help with the visualization or the opening? Just wondered about that.
Well, a couple of things come to mind, of course. The first is patience.
Yeah.
Never my strong point, but I know it's no, it's important. And letting go expectations, whatever extent we can, you know. One of the key feedback signs is thinking, this isn't working right, or I'm not doing it right. And, you know, sometimes that's true. You're not doing it right, but much more often it's being confronted with a discomfort, disappointment, sadness, etc.
Mm-hmm.
That is feedback that there's an attachment to some ideal. So that is a key recognition, of course, in all practices. Suzuki Roshi had a wonderful line. He said, we should be very grateful when we feel disappointed with our practice. It shows we have a gaining idea. One of the nice things about the mandala offering practice is it really is set up in a way to be relatively easy, in that we're provided with a template which lends itself to wanting to give. Let's see, what else? Those are the main things that come to mind.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to go back to your point before about your own practice, that you had a sense that there was definitely a building, that the devotion, for example,
mm-hmm.
of the refuge provided a context for other practices.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's very true. And, you know, I'd love to know what happened if different people did the practices in different order, but certainly I'm aware that the benefits from doing one fed into the others, and that together they create this wonderful mandala of some kind of a richness and complexity of depth far beyond what I can appreciate. Maybe we can go into the practice and some of the levels of the practice, because one of the things that Surya Das taught us, which was most helpful for me, and not only for the offering practice, but for all the Nundra practices, was that it could be appreciated and done from various levels. And that each level drew on, added to, and transcended the previous level. And as so often in the Tibetan tradition, one division is into outer, inner, secret, and top secret, or Nimanakaya, Sambhogakaya, Dhammakaya, and Svavivekakaya, non-dual. The outer, we can think of in a couple of ways. Of course, it's the physical offering practice. But it's also the Nimanakaya, or form level, where the emphasis is in the visualization. It's more on the actual images. And here one is offering the threefold thousand universe filled with everything positive, including one's personal possessions and treasures and so forth, as vast as you can conceive of it. And you give it happily. And that, to my mind, seems to be a key element of facilitating the practice and making it joyful. And I actually experimented with the mantra at one stage. I gladly offer all that is for the awakening and happiness of all. And what I've learned in doing the Brahmavihara practices and these and other practices is that it's helpful to choose one's words with care, because each word tends to evoke the corresponding experience. So I gladly offer. It's a very different experience for me than just I offer. And I gladly offer all that is for the awakening and happiness of all evokes a very different experience from just the awakening of all.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, that's my experimental side coming out, but that was one of the recognitions that I found very important for making it a joyful practice. So the mandala offering, as with so many Vajrayana practices, can be conceived of and recognized and practiced at many different levels. Distinctions are between things such as outer, innermost and secret, or Nirmanakaya, Sambhogakaya, Dharmakaya, and non-dual, Svabhavikakaya. And in terms of the mandala offering, the outer offering, the Nirmanakaya, is both the physical offering and the offering of the threefold thousand universe, filled with everything positive, including personal possessions and treasures of every conceivable kind, as vast as you can conceive of. So you're basically giving everything positive you can conceive of and offering it to the Buddha and all beings. And in my own experience, it's really important to do this with a sense of joy. That is to emphasize doing it happily and joyfully. And I found it was helpful at times myself to use a mantra such as, I gladly offer all that is for the awakening and happiness of all. And that I gladly offer all that is for the awakening and happiness of all actually has a couple of words in there which specifically evoke happiness. And the key there is that the cultivation of happiness as part of the giving, of course, cultivates happiness in us, and also happiness, joy, tend the natural tendency of a joyous mind is to want to share the joy. So the practice both cultivates and becomes an expression of joy. So one offers all that one can conceive of in positive terms, and one does it with as much joy as possible. Then there's an inner or Sambhogakaya offering. And here you shift from the physical sense of offering the threefold universe to offering all experiences and all attachment to experiences. So anything you can think of that's positive or that you might be attached to, you offer. Offer all achievements and attainments, all pleasures and, of course, pains, all glories, all delights, and also offer everything you can conceive of in the inner world. All visions and bliss, the guru of guru yoga, anything you can conceive of that brings you joy and happiness, or it can be negative, but here the emphasis is on offering to all that which is most positive, and here offering the most positive experiences you can think of or have experienced or even glimpsed in your inner world. Then there's the innermost or Dharmakaya offering, or innermost offering of giving up whatever arises, all phenomena and noumena, any experience that arises whatsoever is offered up. And not only every phenomenon, every experience that arises, but giving up even attachment to anything that arises, and offering up the very desire to purify or attain or gain in any way. So giving up purifying, giving up improving, giving up one's own self-improvement tasks, giving up even awakening, giving up being any way other than you are, giving up the hope of the world being better or different, and giving up getting anything from the practice. So anything you can conceive of that might be positive for you or beneficial or improving of you or others, giving that up. And then finally, there's the secret or non-dual practice, giving up even the idea that you're offering, recognizing that actually everything is already primordially pure, that everything already is a self-offering, that everything that arises is offering itself to the Absolute, that it is an offering from the Absolute to the Absolute, that is the entirety of manifestation, every experience, every phenomenon, all that arises, all that manifests is a projection, exteriorization, the divine play, manifestation of the Absolute, and it is offering itself to the Absolute. And recognize that you yourself are being offered. It's not that you are doing the offering, but rather that you and the offering are already an offering of the Absolute. The Absolute is expressing, creating, manifesting you and the practice as an offering to itself. And recognize and rejoice in the fact that actually there is nothing but offering. Everything that is arising is always already an offering. There is nothing you can do to offer because it is already being offered. Recognize that there is only Buddha activity, that every experience that arises, including the experiences of offering or difficulties in offering, are themselves an offering. They are all the play of Buddha. Recognize that there is only Leela. Every conceivable experience is part of the divine play. Every conceivable phenomenon, every activity, every thought that arises in your mind, every image, every conception of who and what you are is merely the divine at play. You are always already an offering. You are always already an aspect of the divine. You are always already a creation of, the manifestation of, and one with the divine. There is nothing to be done. It is always already just as it is, and there is nothing to do but enjoy and rejoice. And this is the final practice. And may we all recognize that all we do is an offering. May we cultivate that recognition, but at the same time recognize that our very cultivation is already an offering. And may all beings be as fortunate as we are, and may we and our practice be the means for their good fortune.